All right, good morning to everybody. We're just about to commence class, about a minute or two, picking up in Koheles, chapter 2, verse 18, and we'll see if we may conclude the chapter today. We'll see. A number of verses there. All right, well, again, we'll start just momentarily. Josh, how you doing? I got that email about the different locations of Pyro's name, so I'll take a look at that. Thanks for those for that effort. That was a lot of work, it seems.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you. Yeah. And Kim, are you on?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Okay, good morning.
Okay. All right, so we're picking up from Koheles. Chapter 2, verse 18. Let's do is I'll read it to the end of the chapter, because not necessarily that we take the chapters as being divinely made, but sometimes they do end on a an appropriate spot, because again the chapters were made by the Christians. Used for debating purposes to have some reference points, whereas the Torah itself, the breaks are in terms of gaps of letters. So that's how God indicates that a certain portion is completed. And the reason for that is that a person has to have a concept as to what is the subject matter that he's going to analyze. If he analyzes too much, then he won't be able to come up with a theory for all of the information that's enclosed in his arbitrarily made section, but if he follows the sections that God indicated, then he'll be pointed towards correct ideas and correct themes. For example, if a person works for a garment manufacturer, and the garment manufacturer wants him to create, or he wants him to categorize a whole bunch of garments, and he gives him everything from jackets and ties and pants and belts. So the worker is going to come up with a plan for the entire ensemble. But if the employer only gave him slacks, so then he'll be able to focus more in terms of what's the theory of the slacks and how does the waistline have to be cut and the inseam and the cuffs and whatever is going on, that's germane only to that limited scope. So when he's focusing on the limited scope, he'll be able to have more knowledge regarding, or accurate knowledge, as opposed to what pants are. But if he tries to define pants and is also looking at jackets and ties and so on, he will not come up with the correct theory of what pants really are, because he's including too much extraneous information. Actually, not too much, but he's including extraneous information into what he's trying to categorize. He will have to come up with a wrong idea. Another example would be if trying to define animal, and when I look at animals, I also include rocks and plants. So if I try to bring all those things into a unified definition, I will not be able to have a correct theory of what animal is, because I'm also trying to fit a rock and a plant into that theory too. But if I exclude that and I look at only the category of animal and everything else is excluded, and I set my parameters properly, then I will arrive at an accurate definition of what animal is, because that is all I am looking at in terms of my analysis. So the Torah as well. It's important that when we first look into an area, that we know where the area begins and ends. Otherwise, we're going to have, it'll be impossible to have a correct notion. You see that idea?
Yeah. Does the gap appear, I mean, it appears in the Torah, does it appear in all the books of the Tanakh, the separate chapters?
If they're written properly, they'll have some sort of a marking. They'll have to be like the Hebrew letter Pei or the Hebrew letter Samach, which are, indicate a Pei stands for Psucha, which means like the line in the Torah, normally, you know, typical lines in the Torah, that when there's no break, you know, you have text being written in the column from the right edge all the way to the left edge. But when God wants to indicate that there's an end of an area, you'll either have the words end before it reaches the end of the column, or you'll have a gap in letters, about 9 letters, and then it'll pick up again, which is called closed off. So if you could imagine that there's lines of text that fill up an entire horizontal row. And they keep going, one below the next, then all of a sudden, you see the text only reaches halfway through the horizontal line, and it stops. So that's called an open, a psucha, where it means that it's that actual line is open. There's no text going into the end. Or sometimes it's closed, which means that there's a gap of text, but then the letters do pick up again towards the end of that horizontal row. So that's what each one indicates. Yeah, books that are written properly will have indications, yes. And this way you'll be able to see where you should stop your reading and then now understand that you have a closed area, a self-contained area.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right, so let's read. So we're now at 2:18. So King Solomon says as follows. He says, "And I hated the work, my work, that I labored underneath the sun." Again, you see the phrase "under the sun." That I will leave to another person that is after me. Right? So now he's talking about the concept of leaving over wealth or possessions. After me means after what? What point is that referring to when he says after me?
After his death.
Exactly. Good. Okay. And he says in the next verse, "And who knows whether he'll be wise or he'll be a fool, and he'll rule over all of my work that I labored, and I cleverly had amassed." Again, under the sun. And then he concludes this verse by saying, "But this is also a futility." All right. So question number one, what exactly is the futility he's talking about? Also, how is this different than the previous verse? Previous verse 17, that we did 2 weeks ago, he said again, "And I hated life, for it was evil upon me, this work that was done under the sun. Everything is futile and a vexation of spirit." So what is his new concept in 18? He already said that he hated life. Now he's saying, "And I hated all my work that I performed under the sun." So that's the second question. Really first in the order of the verses. So if you want to just jot it down, somebody, this way we know we should come back to these questions. Okay. And then he says in 19 again, that then who knows whether the person I'm going to leave this to is going to be wise or foolish. And he's going to rule over all my work that I labored under the sun. And this is a futility, he says. All right. 20. "So therefore I returned in my heart to just forego ownership, to give up ownership of my heart on all the work that I worked under the sun. For there is a man that will work with wisdom and with understanding and with righteousness. And to another man that did not work, he will give his portion. This also is a futility and a great evil. For who knows? For what pleasure? Ki ma'hove, what hano, what pleasure? According to the Targum. So he says, hove means hano, pleasure. For what pleasure is there to man, but all of his work? And with the vexation and the toil of his heart, that he labors under the sun. This is about the fourth time he said under the sun here. He wants to make it clear. What's the message? We'll have to see. But now you see key, the beginning of this verse of 22, he says, he starts off with the word because. So that means he's explaining something. And he says, for what pleasure does man attain with all of the labor and the toil of his heart that he labors under the sun? 23, next verse. For all of his days are in pain and anger. I mean, the whole matter is very, it gives him a lot of anxiety and pain. Even at night, he does not sleep. His heart does not lie down. This is also a futility. There's no good really for man, except for the fact that he should eat and drink and see his soul well, to see himself to enjoy in his work. I have also seen that this is really a gift of God. For who will eat and who will sense anything except for me? And now we're up to 26. For a man that is good before him, before God, does he give, does God give wisdom and knowledge and gladness? But to the sinner, he has given the matter to that sinner to gather, to accumulate, meaning wealth, and then only to give it over to one who is good before God. This also is a futility and a vexation of spirit. Okay. So that's the end of the chapter. And he says a lot. Now, if you remember last time we were talking, take a look at verse 16, just to get a bearings again. So 2:16 talks about that he says there was no remembrance to the wise man with the fool. And how? And he says at the end of that verse, how is it that the wise man dies just as the fool? And that's therefore he concluded, he says, I hated life because the man was evil upon me. That was done under the sun. For everything is futile and vexation of spirit. So as we said in the past, under the sun means, this is really how he keeps reminding us that all of his sentiments here are sentiments if the scope of analysis is limited to a person's assessment of man on earth, under the sun, on earth, earthly life alone. If that is all the range of activity that you are analyzing, and that is all you are assessing is man's stay here, then you will have this response that he's having. Meaning, it's an abbreviated assessment. It's not looking at the entire picture of man, which lives after this world. But again, what King Solomon is trying to do... Yes?
Is there a reason he uses the term of... You know, over and over again, he says, under the sun, why doesn't he say, on the earth? Why is it under the sun?
I don't know.
I mean, you think he would have chosen that pretty carefully, you know, that he uses it so many times.
Yeah. I mean, what more is he gaining by under the sun as opposed to saying, on earth?
Yeah.
on Earth, though, would be a clearer statement that you're only talking about physical life. Perhaps he is trying to obscure that a bit. It's something he wants the person to look into. I mean, that's clearly, you know, his book of Proverbs as well. If you would say on Earth, so that is a more of a clear statement to me. I mean, what's your feeling on that? Isn't that more of a clear statement that you're talking about just your physical life?
Rabbi?
Yes.
This may be a real leap, but man's always trying to see if we can put life on other planets and things. So maybe it's, you know, for all time, that if we should end up succeeding in that, it's more than just living on the Earth.
Wow, sounds unrelated. I agree, it's a leap. Doesn't sound like it's part of his line over here.
I mean, can I throw in a question too?
Sure.
So, when we look at, and the studies we've done in the book of Proverbs, you know, we're looking at a practical life and how the righteous have a good life and the wicked do not, but we do that study, at least kind of independent of thinking about the world to come. This seems to be saying you can't have any real pleasure or joy or anything without the sort of life on the planet's a drag, but if you are factoring in the fact that the world to come will come eventually, then it'll be good.
Not true. You'll see right here in these verses, he doesn't even. He actually says the opposite. He says that there's no real good for man except for the fact that he should eat and drink and look at and enjoy his position, the status of his soul in his work. And he says it again, that in 26, a man that is good before God, he is given wisdom and knowledge and happiness. Okay, so there is an enjoyable life on earth. What he is addressing are the certain unquestioned assumptions that people carry around with them, the things that bother them. And he is slowly going through all different areas of human life and on man's misconceptions as to what really will give him happiness, and he's exposing it, which is just marvelous because, you know, like here he talks about, to answer our first question, that he previously was talking about how he hated life because the issue up to this point, up to 18, he was talking about, like in verse 16, he says, there's not going to be a remembrance to the wise man or the fool. And it seems to be that the whole life, I mean, the person's life, is his whole span of time, is what he was looking at there. Here, and he says that therefore he hated the life. You see that in 17? What he says is that, and again, he's speaking from the position. What I'm suggesting over and over again is that he's verbalizing sentiments that people have, wrong sentiments, but he verbalizes it as if he has it in order to allow the reader to say, yeah, I feel that way. So, because the first step to correcting a misconception is to get the person to admit that he has it. So what's his method of allowing a person to admit the misconception? If he portrays himself as if he has it. Right? Allows the person to justify, yeah, I feel that way too. And I mentioned to you, that's exactly what Caleb did when the spies came back with the evil report and they really incited a riot. They said, these people there are like giants, we won't win, even though God told them, I will fight for you, don't worry. But these people did not bring God into the equation. These spies, the 10 out of the 12 spies were evil. So what did Caleb do? He got up and he says, because he was a good guy, and he wanted to correct the flawed notion, the seeds of doubt that these spies had now spread, and there was a tremendous cry from all the people. So Caleb gets up and he says, is that all Moses did? And they thought that he was going to add on more evil things so that people quieted down to listen. But then he said, didn't he give us the man? Didn't he split the sea? Didn't he do all these things through God? So you see, he went with the emotion in order to get there, to grab the ear. Same thing over here, I believe.
Okay, and I may be I may be getting ahead of you, but in verse 26, when it says that, you know, for to a man who is good in God's sight, he gives him wisdom and knowledge and joy and so forth, the sinner, he gives this other stuff, and then he says, this too is vanity and frustration. Is that last comment referring to the whole verse?
You'll see. We'll see. We'll get to it.
Okay.
Yeah. Rabbi?
Yes.
Ask a question, please.
Yes, go ahead.
In reference to under the sun, I was just looking back. In verse 1.5, the explanation, the footnotes in the Tanakh that I'm reading here, it says, this verse refers allegorically to the wicked. Although the sun of wicked people shines and they prosper, ultimately their sun will set. So instead of saying on the earth, he's saying under the sun, maybe in this respect, because the sun shines for the wicked as well. And on the other side, I was thinking as well, saying under the sun means to encompass everything that happens as well throughout the universe, on other planets, if it's supposed to be considered other planets as well. Does that make any sense?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't bring in other planets. I mean, we're just persons living his life here. I'm not really sure the concept, you know, under the sun. I mean, it's more of like, you know, homiletic type of thing, the first one that you were quoting, under the sun, that it's also good for the wicked too. But I think there has to be something more. I always like to go for the actual literal words, meaning how is under the sun different than being on the earth, is really Josh's question. I don't think that really answers it.
Right,
right.
Okay.
I just thought of a theory on this.
Yeah.
Saying under the sun places the earth in, you know, it's beneath something, that there's something like greater than the earth, which kind of, you know, subconsciously maybe makes someone look for, you know, there's a better existence, there's a higher existence.
That there's a higher existence. So when you say, when he's saying, and referring to human life, the physical existence, and he refers to that as under the sun, so he's saying it's also straddling, it's hinting to a higher existence. But that's just the opposite of what he's trying to say. He's trying to say, if you just look at the scope of activity limited to your physical existence, which is under the sun, then all these sentiments could carry some weight.
So he's saying that by saying under the sun, he'd be saying, you know, that the physical existence is below something.
The physical existence is below something. I hear you.
Which hints that there may be something greater, like a world to come. It's a subtle. You know, if he just said on the earth, there's no hint that. You know what I mean? Just an idea.
I gotta think about it. It doesn't strike me as being under the sun, as opposed to being over the sun, you mean? I mean, there's something on the other side of the sun?
As opposed to just saying, if you just say on the earth, it doesn't say that the earth is, you know, under, but if you say it's under the sun, then it's saying that, there's something that's above the earth. It places the earth in kind of a subservient level to the sun. It's underneath.
That's true. That's true.
Which kind of hints that maybe the life, the existence of the physical world, is also maybe below something else, like the world to come.
That I hear, because now you're using the actual word under. Under means subservient. That's how they used to take swear.
Right.
They used to take a swear, like when Abraham told his servant Eliezer to find a wife for Isaac. So he told him, put your hand underneath me, and he would show like subservience. So when the master would sit on the hand of the servant, it shows that. So like you're saying, under. So that makes sense. It could also be like Rivka said earlier, that under the sun includes everything in physical existence, as opposed to just on the earth. It's more of an inclusive statement. Meaning, all if we look at all things physical, and that to me, I'm inclined more towards that, because that's really what he opened the book with, is saying that, like Rabbi Chait explained, he says the word futility 7 times in the first verse, I believe, to indicate that everything is futile in terms of number 7, meaning that which was created in the 7 days of creation, the 6 days of creation, and when God rested on the 7th. So if we just look at the physical and assess it as a ends in itself, then it's futile. So when he says under the sun, that means to say the entire universe. If we just look at the entire physical universe and that's all we're assessing, then forget it. You're going to have complaints that really will carry some weight. So that to me seems to be a better answer. It's also, I agree, I'm not rejecting what you're saying about the subservient aspect. But I think that this is more, this is better in terms of his theory that when we look at the entire physical, what's the entire physical? It's not just what's on earth, but it's everything under the heavens, under the sun. All right, give us a thought. I lean towards the second one. Okay, let's go back to the verses, because we do have a bit to do. You hear what I'm saying, Josh?
Yeah, I was muted there, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so again, up to 18, he's talking about life, meaning if you look at the whole range of life of the righteous person or the wicked person, they both die. So if we just look at death as being the ultimate end, so then you're right. That's what it says under the sun. If you look at the way that death meets both the righteous person, the wise person, and the wicked person, fine. Now he's moving on to not life, but now he's talking about amali, my work. That's why if you're sensitive to the words, you'll see, he says, and I hated my work, which I labored under the sun. So for one, he's looking at different aspects of where people invest value, and where it really is going to hurt them, because they have the wrong assessment of what can give you happiness, and that's why you are not happy. So now he's trying to help the individual step by step. Where are the different areas of life that a person makes mistakes? And let's see if we can remove your false assessment. So now he's approaching not the view about the worth of life. That was one topic. Now he's moving on to the topic, which is about what about my personal labors, my personal accomplishments. So if I now am going to leave it over to another person, right? He says, I now have a problem with this. And you see that again. He's saying, and I hated all the work that I labored under the sun, that I will leave it to a person that will be after me. What's the problem with that? What is the value of a person who says that? And then he says afterwards, in the next verse, and who knows whether he'll be wise or foolish, and he'll rule over all my work that I labored, and that I became, that I was clever about accomplishing. And then he says, this is a futility. Let's just take those two verses and try to understand that. What is the false view that he is now exposing regarding a person's possessions? What is it that he hates? What is the futility? What is the misconception?
Rabbi, could the misconception be leading into some sense of immortality because you want to leave something of yourself?
Okay. All right, but he it seems to be under the sun, though, is where the scope of this is right now. And he's bothered while he's still alive about it, clearly. This bothers the person while they're alive. I'm going to do all this work and so on, and now it seems to be, I know I'm going to leave this planet, and I'm going to leave it to somebody after me. But that's not the problem. The problem is he wise or not? He's going to rule over all my work. And this, he says, that is a futile thing. That's a futility. So it seems to be he accepts that he's going to have his own mortality, and he's going to leave it, an inheritance. But now something bothers him about that.
fact that he doesn't have any control over it.
Okay, so the person, if you had to tell me where a person is looking for happiness in this area and what the flaw is, how would you describe that? Right? We have to take this now to the bottom and see what exactly is the problem that he's bringing into focus right now.
Could it be the I guess, fantasy that we want to have control over everything, and yet the reality is that we do not, and the recognition of that is difficult.
Good. That also stems from another thing, though. That also stems from something that you were saying that before, Cal, regarding the immortality. That the person's flaw over here is that he's worried about something that's going to happen after he's gone. See, this is the trick of the mind. That a person really can't stop viewing himself as having some sort of relationship to this wealth even after he's dead. He doesn't accept the fact that he is gone at a certain point. That's why he feels that even after I'm gone, it's going to be bothersome. But if a person feels clear, the real idea the person should see is that it doesn't matter at all who has it after I'm gone, because there will not be any awareness of that. That shouldn't bother a person. It only bothers a person if he can't give up the concept that he will have no knowledge or no relationship to this world after he's gone. But that's something which a person can't do. That's where the immortality comes in. I mean, at the same time that he's saying, I'm going to leave this world, I'm going to leave an inheritance, so he admits, on the one hand, yes, I am leaving. On the other hand, he's too attached to what? In order to... And now it produces a problem. He's too attached. He says in the beginning of 18, and I hated my work. And then he says 19, I'm going to leave it to a person who, I don't know if he's going to be a wise or a fool, and he's going to rule over my work, that I was wise and I toiled. You see the I so many times? He can't divorce himself from the wealth, the ownership. It seems to be that ownership is a very strong emotion. And like you were saying also, I think Doug, you mentioned that about control. But there is a, what is the underlying fantasy behind this? Is that a person feels that that is going to give him some benefit if he leaves it over a proper way. But the truth is, it can't benefit him. He's not around anymore. But that's what the person doesn't face. So he's now... There's a number of things going on here, but the main misconception is that there is going to be some pleasure through my work. It's mine. I labored. Right? You see that in the words again. And I hated all my work that I labored under the sun. I'm leaving it to somebody who is after me. That's bothersome. It's mine. Right, so there you see the emotion of something I accomplished it. It's my hands. So now he'll get some satisfaction he feels. At the moment, while he's alive, if he could fantasize that I'll be leaving it over to a wise son, okay, I got a piece of life now. But you'll see even that he shows is not correct. But he sees clearly that I do not know who's going to get it. So the first mistake is living your life trying to derive pleasure from that which is not, doesn't offer pleasure. It's a fantasy. If a person is trying to get pleasure from the fact about some unknown inheritance that it'll be spent properly by a wise son, but that's a futile time. That's what he means is futile. That's what he says at the end of 19. He's not ranking on life again. It sounds that way. What he is ranking on, what he is rejecting, is to have this type of a lifestyle where you carry around certain fantasies that there's no control over, and you're not going to even be there in order to get the enjoyment of it. So it's an imagined, protracted type of a pleasure which never takes place. He's imagining that there will be some benefit from this, but he's not there. That's the biggest error he's making. But he does come to terms with the fact that who knows who's going to get it. So that ruins that very fantasy. So the fantasy itself is a problem. And also because you're not going to be around to be watching watching your wise son spend it properly, you're not going to be there. The only thing is that a person's immortality can't really face that. That's number one. And number two is that there's really no control, because maybe a fool is going to get my money. So that's what he calls futile. This very pursuit, this very fantasy. What does he say in 20? So he says, I then returned on my heart to just give up, meaning to relinquish this attachment of ownership. Right? The word yish, to give up the ownership. So I'm going to just force my heart to relinquish attachment on all of my work that I worked under the sun. Okay, that makes sense. Because since the problem is having that attachment to the wealth and thinking that the ownership is something which is eternal, you realize, no, that's not good. That's not even real. So the right response would be to relinquish this ownership. In 21, he says, next he says, for there are men, there's a man that will work with wisdom and with understanding, and, you know, and he'll be righteous. And to a person that did not work, he'll give his portion. So he isolates now the phenomena, because this is a reality. But you see again, his portion. You see that in 21? A man will work with righteousness and wisdom, and to another man that didn't work for it at all, he's going to give his portion. Meaning it's not his, it's my portion. You see the problem? That's what we said. A person's attached, it's the ownership. A person doesn't want to part with that. All right, so far so good?
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understand. It's the idea of ownership of the work and the results?
Yeah, the labor, whatever produce, whatever monies or houses or buildings, whatever it is that he built or purchased or accumulated or produced, there's a sense of ownership. And this is something which bothers a person, that it is mine and now it's not going to be mine. It's something which is a flaw in life, that you see buildings that people make, homes. I mean, I see it out here. And these are, you know, religious people. And they invest so much money and time, and they make these elaborate homes. And like Robert Chait said once, I think it was a Hearst mansion, like, you know, you make something which you barely get any use out of. But you spend your entire life accumulating the money and working in the office from 9 to 9. You know, it's no more 9 to 5. That's been over for 50 years. You know, people are putting in these 10, 12, 14-hour days, and for what? And then laboring, and then they have to find home, and then they imagine that people will pass by the home, and they'll look at it. And meanwhile, the guy never goes into, you know, 9 out of the 10 rooms. Well, I guess a better description would be, he doesn't go into 25 out of his 30 rooms in the house. And it's all for an image, it's all for a staff. But, and that house will stand for 100, 200, 300 years, and he's only here for 70. So it's a grave imbalance, but it's not analyzed. It's not something which is an activity. If a person would have read this chapter in Kohelis, he would not have done it. Because look what he's doing. He's putting his whole life in for what? So somebody after him is going to have a house easily without doing any work. Right? You see, that's the added thing that he adds in 21. Because he already said that somebody who is a fool can rule over my work. But now he has a point that he did not even work for it. 21 has a point that, you know, you could have a person who's righteous and does everything properly with intelligence, and then a person who didn't work at all gets it. Another bothersome thing. I put on all this labor. It's me. I invested all this energy. But that the problem is because the person invested in the wrong things. He really felt that this is a value. When really, it's not. You're not going to have it for very long. He says later on, look what he says in the very next verse. He really brings it to a head, the problem. 22. What pleasure is there to man with all the work and all the vexation of his heart that he labors under the sun? Meaning, this very, you know, this very idea that there is not going to be any real He doesn't derive anything from it. He put so much energy in to finally build this thing, and by the time he's 80 years old, he leaves this earth, and this he worked and worked and worked for what? For a house that somebody else uses? What the person should have really done is metered in the amount of energies that he puts into this life that he actually benefits in the best way. Life is really for approaching wisdom and seeing more of reality. That's why we have intelligence and no other creature does. So a person should try, like the Pirkei Avos says, a person should minimize his work and maximize his time learning, because you don't take any of the work with you, and it's you leave it to somebody else. See, it's a person here that's too attached to his possessions that has these complaints. This is not something which bothers King Solomon. He just understood how to bring to the foreground the different notions that most people carry around with them, and what their values are, and what drives them, and he's trying to expose the flaw. So he exposed a number of flaws already, but now he says another one. He says that, what real pleasure are you getting from it? Let's just stop and think for a minute. Did you really get any pleasure? He says in 22, no. What pleasure did man get with all this toil? It was an imagined type of thing. The fantasies of having the big home, the statement, the skyscraper building for my empire that I built over 50 years of laboring. But he says, where's the real Hana? Why? What does he define as real pleasure? What does King Solomon define as real pleasure? Let's read on. 23, he says, and we'll go back. I know I'm going a little bit at a pace here, but the flow, it'll help us keep the flow too. He says, for all his days are in pain. Meaning now he's qualifying the previous statement. What real pleasure did the person get? Let's look at his life. All of his days are in pain and in anger. He's always hit with frustration. Nothing goes exactly as planned. So that means all of his days are painful, trying to do all this accumulation. Even at night, his heart does not sleep. Why? Because he's worried about his money. Pirkei Avos says that as well. Ethics of the Fathers says that as well, that you increase your possessions, you increase your anxiety. There's more to worry about. So you can't even sleep at night. So we take a snapshot that this person who's living with this type of a thought, this fantasy, I'm going to accumulate wealth, work long, hard hours, build up an empire, make a big home, and all this, have amassed great wealth. But during the entire, all those decades of accumulation, because of this unchecked idea he had in his head, this notion that this is going to be pleasurable, in reality, all his days, that's what the verse says. 23. They're in pain and anger. He's met with frustration. Even at night, he does not sleep. And this also is a futility. I mean, in the process itself doesn't afford any pleasure. So what does he say the real pleasure is? That's the next verse. He's not going to leave us hanging. In 24, he says, there's no real good for man other that he should eat and he should drink and then he should see his soul good in his work. Meaning a certain sense of accomplishment. This I have seen, that this is from God. Meaning this is really the right plan. Why? Listen carefully. 25. For who will eat and who will have any sensation except for me? Okay, well, what did he just say? What is his rule?
Doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks or the image I'm putting out there, that the only thing that really is going to affect me is what happens to me?
Yes, meaning the real pleasure, the real enjoyment you'll have in life is your own experience. Not the fantasies in your head that you're assuming of what people will say about you, or you're assuming that somebody will have something after you long you're dead and buried. All these thoughts, he's trying to show people do have them, right? These are very popular type of notions. And you see, I go down the street and I see a house after house that's being knocked down. They have plenty of room for the people, and they build these monstrosities, tremendous amount of money, because somebody else did the same thing, or because they need to make a statement, or because this is really life, but they don't realize that they don't stay here very long. But they're fighting that. They're fighting that. The only real pleasure you'll have is not the fantasies in the in your head that you project. This is how the world's viewing me, or this is how I think it's going to be after I'm gone. What is the real pleasure you have? It's your own experience. Did you eat something? Did it taste good? Did you have a good sensation? Did you have a good... You feel rested now. You took a nap. Everything else is really just fantasy. But the people don't face that because everybody else is doing it. And therefore, if the masses do it, they assume there must be something to it. A person looks to get fame because he imagines. He can be propelled for decades climbing the ladder of success because he has one fantasy in his head of what they're going to say about me when I finally get there. So this fantasy, which may never come true, is what's pushing him to kill himself day and night and work. And he accumulates money, and he can't even sleep because he's worried about the money, like he said in verse 23. So you see how one single false notion can propel a person because he hadn't questioned it. And here King Solomon says very simply, these things are all futile. They do not afford what you think. It's a fantasy. It's not real. It does not happen. What is it that you really enjoy? Have a nice bottle of wine, a steak, right? Who's going to eat and who's going to sense except for me? That's a reality. That's something that you perceive. And he says in 26, the last verse, he says that for a man that is good before God, he gives him wisdom and knowledge and happiness. So you see, if a person does live properly and he's using intelligence, then he could really arrive at what's really happy. I mean, there's a story, there's one rabbi that the Talmud talks about how he was crying before he died, and the reason was because he left over one stick of carob, one piece of fruit, and that bothered him. It bothered him because that showed that there was an imbalance in his life. He worked a little bit more than he really consumed, and he could have used that time that he had to labor to produce that one additional fruit. He could use that time for his learning, for what he really enjoyed, and he felt bad. He regretted that there was such a... He was a... You know, again, and you can't say that this person had any money, really, if this is the way he was living. And he only left over one piece of fruit. He must have been the poorest of the poor. But yet, what was his anguish in life? It was not that he didn't have anything. It was just the opposite, that he had too much. I mean, it's such a real salient point. Here's a person who left over only one piece of fruit. That's all he had to show for himself as he was dying. And that, you'd think, would bother a person that he didn't lead a life of wealth. Just the opposite. He invested a little bit more time and work than was necessary. So he was living properly. He was living daily. He lived for the day. There was to leave over something was not... that could even be damaging. I mean, it's true if you have money, you leave it over to your son. There's a way, there are laws about that, how you leave over things. I don't think that there's any statement anywhere that you have to work in order to leave over something to your child. If you have it, you leave it over. If a person lives very simply, like this rabbi, there was no violation. There's no law that you must work in order to leave over something to your child. No, let your child learn the perfection of labor too. Let him learn the value of work, of breaking his back a bit, and really, you know, the toil. Doesn't mean that you have to be like a slave. When I say break your back, I mean to put the effort in, to apply yourself, and then see the fruits. And that's exactly one of the pleasures he says here, that in 24, that there ain't tov adam. There's no other good for man than he should eat and drink and see his soul good in his labor. So there's a certain satisfaction when that is a good. That's why God created the emotion of satisfaction. It is necessary because that helps a person propel himself. That sense of where I'm going to get to, but it's a realistic vision that he has, a realistic plan. He's not trying to assume enough wealth for an entire country to have. He works enough that he has and his family has. But you see, the very last pasuk too, 26, is that he gives another reason why this whole thing is futile. This attempt to make its money and leave it over to others. What's the other reason why it's a futility? Because it's God that gives it. He says it twice. Right? For the one who is good before God, does God give wisdom and knowledge and enjoyment. And to the sinner, he gives the matter of accumulating wealth and gathering possessions, to give those things to someone who is good before God. So King Solomon says, you see, this is really something which God decides anyway. The whole attempt at control over the wealth is foolish anyway, because God is really doing that. And we actually say that in the beginning of the year, where we say that on Rosh Hashanah, that God decides who's going to live, who's going to die, who will be wealthy, who will be poor. So this is something which he's reiterating that point.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Well, how do we balance the two ideas, or reconcile them, that God gives it all over, and yet, at the same time, I'm responsible to go out and get busy and earn it?
Right. There are laws of nature. We have to operate in the natural world. Now, if we don't water the seed that we planted, it will die. A person, even though God plans what you're going to make this year, you can't say, well, since God planned it, I'll just sit in my house with my hands folded. I'm not going to work because it was already decided. The only thing is, you don't know what God decided. So we have to function in the world. I'm actually reading this right now in the book called Duties of the Heart. It's put out by Feldheim Publications. Very important. I suggest that you all get it. It's a two-volume. It comes small. It's a blue book, two volumes. Duties of the Heart. And there's one gate. The book is separated into 10 different gates, 10 different chapters. And in the gate of trust, so he talks about this very point. How he says that a person should not come to rely. First of all, he says the person has to work. The world works a certain way. And he says, but God still is running the world in terms of what your needs are going to be this year. And there's nothing which anybody can do that can affect God, which is clearly true. He says at the same time, do your labor, do your work. Your due diligence, and whatever God decided for you, you will have. And he also talks about a point that a person should, if he had money for a certain amount of time and then it was taken from him, he should say, all right, he should be happy with the fact that God gave it to me and he deposited it with me for some amount of time, and now he took it away to give it to somebody else. I mean, he should accept reality. He should also, another point he makes is not to come to depend on the means. Because then you're saying that, for example, if a person feels he must have this job, or that's it, now he's valuing the job more than God's abilities. So he makes that point. He says, do what you can, do the best moves. You have to work on the natural law. But you have to rely, your reliance has to be that God is going to do his part. But there is natural order.
So when you say you have to rely on God doing his part, what is his part?
That means trust in him. Have the trust that you're living the right life, he will take care of you. That's why he put you here. If you're living the life where you're in pursuit of God and truth and wisdom, and you're honest in business, and you really want to pass on God's teachings to others, you're doing all the right things, so then trust that this is really God's plan for man, and you're fulfilling it, and he will take care of the person like that. So that's the trust. But God's plan is that you do involve yourself in work, and it's an important thing. He talks earlier, and he says the importance of work is that if a person wasn't working, so then a certain part of his nature wouldn't be satisfied, and he would go into sin. He says it's necessary, and rabbis in Pirkei Avos and Ethics of the Fathers say the same thing, that a combination of Torah study and a worldly pursuit, meaning business, will keep a person away from sin. But if a person is idle and his energy is... he's involved in learning, and then when he's not involved in learning, then what is he doing? So then his emotions are going to kick in, and then he's going to sin. But if he takes those emotions and harnesses them properly, and redirects his ambition and his sense of accomplishment towards building a life for himself, now he will be putting his energies in the right area, and he won't sin. So that's, it's a good, the way the world is designed, that there are energies that God gave us, and we have libido, and we have energy, and we want to accomplish. Yes, because he wants you to be involved in that the world has a certain natural course. Following that natural course, impresses you with that there's a whole design, and there's a designer, it's God. That's also necessary to be involved in the work. That was all due to Adam and Eve. Initially, they had what they needed. They had no clothes, there was no necessary, no need for it, there was no sense of conscience at that point. It was only once they sinned that God, as Rabbi Shade explained, quoting Maimonides, it was only once they sinned and they gave in to the instincts too quickly, then God gave the conscious to the superego to a person. Before that, there was no sense of guilt. It was not necessary. Because the area of wisdom that, that is the highest level is knowledge of what is true and what is false. That's what Adam was doing. He was naming the animals, and he was observing and seeing different natures to different animals. And the fact that he named them meant that he was involved in wisdom. And it even says that whatever he called the animals, that was its name. Meaning to say, his level of wisdom was so high that he was completely accurate in terms of his understanding. And he enjoyed studying the animals and seeing why this one had that trait and this one had another trait. Meaning that the whole creation is a laboratory that God gave man to see a reflection of God's wisdom. But once he sinned, it was very quick for him to sin. The same day that he was created, the Ran explains, like different hours of the day, different things took place. It was all on the same day. And he finally sinned. Adam was created on Friday, and he sinned on Friday, and he was expelled from the Garden of Eden on Friday. So all this took place very quickly. So therefore God added a new component to our psyche, and that's why they had to put clothing on, because they sensed something. God created what we call the superego, the sense of guilt, the conscience. A person felt bad about being naked. He felt a certain morality. That morality did not exist before, because it was not necessary. You don't need morality to understand truths. Morality deals with a different area, what is good and what is bad, value judgments. The reason why God created that, as Rabbi Chaim explained, was in order to give a person a secondary chance not to sin. Because if a person feels bad before they are about to sin, that will help keep them away from sinning. Initially, they didn't have that. They just had the intellect. They were able to understand truths and false, and there was no sense of embarrassment in terms of nudity. There was no idea of what is right and what is wrong. God said not to eat of this. That's it. But evidently, they couldn't function that way. They gave in to their desires, and they rebelled against God. So now, in order to help them not rebel in the future, he gave a secondary break system, you can call it. Meaning now, before they were about to sin in the future, they could have a sense of what, should I do this or not? Which they did not have beforehand. So that was after the sin, but before the sin, they would be involved in wisdom. But you see that work was also necessary. God also gave, he told Adam, now you're going to live by the, you're going to eat by the bread by the sweat of your brow. Meaning, he initially demoted Adam that he would now just eat the grass of the field just like his donkey, but that was too much of a blow to his ego. So God said, okay, I'll give you some elevation of your ego. I'll allow you to make something called bread. You will work with your hands. That will give you a sense of accomplishment, satisfaction. So you see that's necessary. It's necessary for man's well-being that he has a sense of accomplishment and that he can achieve certain goals that he sets for himself. And that's what King Solomon is referring to here when he says in 2:24 that the real good for man, that he eats and he drinks, meaning he really perceives the pleasure himself. Instead of fantasizing that something will happen in the future, which he never really enjoys, that's a foolish thing to do, is to live based on a fantasy. No, real enjoyment is what you actually sense yourself. And also, that you see yourself good in your work. There's a certain sense of satisfaction with your own labor. So that is a good. So we do have to work. We have to realize also that God is going to assist us. I mean, also, there's another factor. There's so many variables at play in the world that it would be virtually impossible for a person to, for every single person who's living properly to get everything they need. God is necessary to intervene and to work things out. Because you see how many variables there are. Just to meet a certain person, to get a certain connection, there's so many things that went into play you don't even know. So it's necessary for the Creator that he's involved in helping us in that respect. But at the same time, we have to work ourselves because it's good psychologically. That's number one. Number two, it also reinforces the, we see how the world operates, and this is the design of the Creator, and that we observe laws. If we don't plant, it doesn't grow. That, at the same time, that we have, it forces us to work, and we get the sense of accomplishment, but we also witness wisdom of how plant life works. So that gives us wisdom of God. So there's many goods. Long answer, Doug. Does it answer your question now?
Yes, I think so. Thanks, Rabbi.
All right. If you want to take a look at that gate in the... Let me see. Let me quickly locate. I think there's one page where he does say that the purpose of work. Let's see if we find it quickly. Yes, here it is. It's page 385 in the first volume. He says, the reason the Creator obliged man to exert himself and search for the means of obtaining a livelihood and other necessities is twofold. First, since divine wisdom demands that trial of the soul with service of God or rebellion against him, I mean, God wants there to be a trial of the soul. So that means man should be tested. So God tries the soul. He tests man with what will reveal its choice in the matter, namely with a need and want for that which is external to it, food, drink, clothing, shelter, and sexual relations. He commanded human beings to seek and obtain these requirements through the available means, in specific ways and at certain times. What the Creator decrees a man should attain of them, the man realizes and attains through ample means which are provided to him. What the Creator does not decree that a man should attain of them, he does not attain, and the means are withheld for him. Right? This is where it complies with what we say in Rosh Hashanah, that God decides what a person makes each year. Then he goes on and he says, his service or sin is demonstrated through his intent and choice of one to the exclusion of the other, meaning when the person is now proves his right ethics in his pursuit of his needs, does he deal properly in business? Is he nice to people? So in these very pursuits, if he didn't have to work, there would be no expression of man trying to go after things in life. And then would he be doing it the right way? So work is a means by which a person demonstrates his conviction in the right morality and the right truths of the Torah. That's why there's so many laws about business dealings and how do you treat others and speaking about people. So that's one reason why work is a good. It allows man to demonstrate his perfection, because perfection can't just be abstract in your mind. It has to be demonstrated. That's exactly what shows a person's conviction of something if he brings himself to action. A person says how great he thinks it is to help people out, to walk people across the street, but he never does it. So you know that there's something amiss. He has a conviction intellectually, but he can't follow through in his actions. That means he's really not convinced. So that's one thing work is good for. And second, he says, if a man did not have to trouble and busy himself in seeking means of obtaining his livelihood, that means to say, if man was completely independent and didn't need food, didn't need clothing, didn't need any shelter, he would rebel and chase after what is forbidden and would pay no attention to what he owes God for his goodness to him. As it says, quote, they have the harp and the lyre and the timbal and the flute and wine at their feasts, and they do not notice God's work. They do not see his handiwork. And this is from Isaiah 5:12. It also says in Deuteronomy that Israel grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, thick, and gross. He forsook God who made him. That's in Deuteronomy 32:15. Again, the masters of blessed memory said, excellent is the study of Torah together with a worldly occupation. For laboring at both puts sin out of his mind. And all Torah without work will in the end be neglected and occasion and sin will, he'll commit sin. That's what we quoted earlier. That's in Ethics of the Fathers 2:2. Okay, and then he ends this paragraph and he says, how much more so is this true of one who has no share in either? Meaning a person does not learn and he does not work. Who concentrates on neither of these pursuits. Okay, page 385, we just read, in the Duties of the Heart, the Feldheim edition. So, we see the necessity right there in terms of work. At the same time, don't think that everything is in our hands. We have to operate, you know, in the physical world. we added a few other reasons why it's good. So we see, you know, plenty of reasons why the work is necessary, the benefit of it, and but at the same time, we understand that it's coming from God. So therefore, since that's the case, do the best you can. But if it comes down to a point where you've done everything you could, don't despair if you didn't get a certain job, because it's not the job that's going to make you wealthy. It's God. All right, so that's an important point.
Rabbi?
Yeah, Doug.
So, he's clearly stating, and I think you quoted Ethics of the Fathers on this, that you need to have both Torah and an occupation.
That's right.
So, two questions. How does what's the rationale behind? I understand certain people will, you know, take up a life of total learning and do no work and somehow be supported by their community. So that's question one. And question two, closely related, which may be the same thing, is there were two tribes. In one agreed to go out and be involved in commerce, and the other agreed to be involved in learning, and then they sort of shared equally amongst the results of those. Is that in any way in contradiction with that?
No. If a person seeks that type of a lifestyle, he's looking for handouts, that's what's wrong. But if, let's say somebody approaches you and says, listen, I'm going to give you a ton of money, free, no strings attached. Should you take it or not? Of course you should take it. Why not? Now, it may still be necessary in terms of the psychological benefits to work, or it may be that you weren't looking for the handout, so you didn't have that imperfection. You were very happy and willing to work. It just so happened that somebody left you a bundle and that's it, you don't have to work anymore. Well, that can be a great thing if you do it wisely. And I'm sure that King Solomon and King David didn't work. They had, you know, very wealthy kingdoms, but they were still involved. They had their own areas where they were running the people, and they were still involved in the community. So, first of all, we always talk about rules as being the general, not the exception. All right, and sometimes we just don't understand things, or for example, there may be a certain need, like the tribe of Levi, that did not work in Egypt and also did not have any land afterwards. It was important that there should be one group of people that were completely immersed in the Torah for the sake of people having the rest of the Jews having it. So that was a necessity. The way that was a very good design. So they still did activities in the temple. They weren't sitting around on the street corners, you know, just drinking all day. They were very active. If it was not training or teaching, so there was definitely activity. So one issue here is that, no, you should not look for handouts. That is wrong. You should work. Because that type of attitude is a corrupt type of attitude. If, however, and the second idea is that if, however, it is presented to you, and you're giving a windfall in wealth and you don't need to work anymore, that can be very good. You definitely have to, you know, monitor yourself and make sure that you're not falling into the critique of somebody who's starting to sin. If you see that, then definitely you have to, despite the fact that you have the money, you have to make sure that you work again. It could be, however, that a person will have that money and he'll be able to do good with it. He'll be able to help the poor, he'll be able to build schools, and so on. I think that would suffice for the same energy going into works. Meaning you could be working for an employer and he's paying you for distributing his wealth. But that's work. Right? It doesn't say what type of work. You're involved in now you could do that same activity with your own wealth. So I think you'd gain the same benefits. But the critique is not to look for that type of lifestyle. The typical person has to earn their own money. Nobody's walking over to people every day. It's an exception when somebody gets a windfall or an inheritance so they don't have to work anymore, especially in today's economy. If you're seeking that and you want other people to give you handouts, that's wrong. That's the critique. Okay?
Okay.
And the thing about the tribe of Issachar and Zebulun, so if they made a certain arrangement, so you can make a business arrangement. They go, I'm not sure exactly how that worked, but there was a mutual agreement over there, so that has to be investigated. Somebody else had a question?
It just sounds like the learning Torah in some of these cases is like work for them. They have a responsibility to learn Torah, so it's not like just a leisure activity.
No, I think when they say that you need the combination of learning Torah and work is because it's two parts of the human personality that it addresses, and that it creates the right equilibrium that the person won't go into sin. If a person is learning Torah, but he doesn't work, duties of the heart, he said, the person will go into sin. Because that part of him that would be, the energies that would be tapped for labor are getting frustrated, and now they have to go somewhere. Those emotions are not being addressed. So your typical individual will have to be involved in that. I'm not saying there aren't cases that certain rabbis were completely immersed in Torah, and they recognized their duty to make sure the Torah was being addressed and that there were answers to questions that Jews had all over the world. So they studied and they did the right thing. And even those rabbis, they would make money by writing their books. That was their labor. They wrote books. They wrote Sefarim, you know, Hebrew books with Torah. That's remember Rabbi Chait saying that's how Rev Moshe Feinstein Zatzal, he made his pronounce, he made his living through the books. He wrote, you know, so many volumes of responsa, and that's how he made his living. But they worked. The rabbis in the Talmud, one was a wood chopper, another one drew water for people. So you know, they weren't afraid of anything. You know, they weren't looking for anything of dignity. That was not the importance. Work was a way that you paid for your bills. But it's wrong if a person's looking for the handout and just wants other people to support it. I often tell people that, you know, the type of attitude that is prevalent in certain communities is that the young boy gets married at 20 and he wants his father-in-law to support him in learning for the next 3 years. So the question is, well, the father-in-law also has an obligation to learn Torah. So why is your learning any more important than his? It's wrong that you should approach him and say, listen, you got to support me now so I can learn for 3 years. No, why don't you work? But see, that's what Pirkei Avos is saying. It's speaking against that attitude to look for a handout. Certainly when you're putting somebody else out, you're making the father-in-law work more, taking away from his learning. Well, that's not right. And if he does it, he's foolish. He should tell his son-in-law, no. You're married, you got to give a daughter a home. You got to work. It's to take away time from your learning. That's God's plan. God's plan is that you have to put time into work. You're trying to deny, it's, you know, God's very plan. Okay. So any questions on the verses that we did, the principles that we did today? You see the whole thing, it's fantasy. And that's what King Solomon is putting down. People carry around numerous fantasies, and slowly, you know, slowly he goes one by one and shows how different notions are false. How people, if they just assess life and different issues based on being under the sun, based on just the earthly existence, so they're looking at it wrong. And then there's so many notions like wanting to leave your money over and thinking about how great that would be, but you don't know if you're going to control the money you're going to leave over. Somebody else who may be a fool is going to take your money. The bottom line is, it doesn't matter. And also, you shouldn't have worked more than you really needed. There's no merit in dying rich. It's during life, a person does it because he wants fame, he wants to make a name. I've got that beautiful big brick monstrosity at the end of the block. That's mine. And look at all the hours and years and decades that I've put into investing so I can have a great empire. And I could think of myself as being a great entrepreneur or a great businessman. It's all these different fantasies that are going on in a person's head, and it's fed because other people do it. But it's hard, you see, it's hard for a person to be an independent thinker. You see that, because that's why you have such a thing called a society. In different worlds, people follow everybody else. They follow the values, and they share the values. Why? They're all right? All these different societies are right? Of course not. But they follow the people because they don't want to be ostracized. They want to be accepted. It's ego. And if you think into it, you'll see so many emotions at work. And King Solomon here, in his great wisdom, and remember, he was given wisdom miraculously by God when he was 12 years old. So there's a tremendous amount to be derived from here. We have to listen to this person. This is divine wisdom that we're reading here. That's why it's one of the books of the Torah, because it's all inspired writings. Somebody had a question? Okay. All right. Any questions or comments? Okay, let's just see if we've got all the points. You have another class starting about 15 minutes, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So why don't we break here? At least we have some time to get ready for that. I'll look it over and make sure we picked up all the points. I think we did fine. I think we covered what I wanted to. If not, we'll pick it up next week. Either way, we'll probably start Chapter 3 next week, so you can start looking into it. All right?
Okay. Thanks, Rabbi.
My pleasure. Okay, good week to everybody.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Okay, have a good day, everybody.
Hey, Josh.